Are there any questions or anything to share?
Then there's like,
yeah,
it's like I can just taste it.
Yep.
And then there's with the inspiration, and there's the like, there's something that maybe I don't totally understand inspiration, maybe I haven't experienced it, but there's one thing which is like when I feel very clear, there's like revelations and aha moments which are very enjoyable. All of a sudden I understand something, like something clicks. But then there's something
very clear. Yeah. So with intuition, you were mentioning that you notice that strong emotion can make it harder to feel the intuition. And also something that we touched on a little bit a couple days ago, but I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak again briefly about it. And so I think there's where with intuition and also with the aha, something clicks, something shifts, and it feels good. Even when what the perspective shift is like not necessarily a flattering thing. Like, oh, I've been ignoring that person without realizing it for 10 years or whatever. The click, the shift into a, maybe we could say alignment, feels good. And so I think that it's great to feel our way towards clarity of what feels good because I think I'm getting what I want. What feels kind of good, or I think it feels good because I'm excited. And sometimes the excitement is an avoidance of just staying still with what is, or in an alignment, or in connection. And that might happen more often when our intuition is still. The intuition isn't saying go left or right. It's not giving an instruction to be active. and we're like fine to follow our intuition as long as we're being told to do something, being useful, etc. So I find that it's through experience that it becomes clear and more and more refined. So that means sometimes it gets clear, and then maybe our ability to feel our intuition refines more, so we're confused for a while again, and then it refines more, we feel more clearly, periodically confused on the way towards deep, clearly feeling the intuition, which then there's less sort of negotiation. There's less me involved. Like, shall I ask my intuition to go left or right? Shall I go left or right? It's just a going. Gradually, it gets finer and finer. But then I think we still easily get confused when the intuition is also quiet. And we can feel quite agitated. And the feeling of, what am I going to do with this? All this energy. Now that I've rested a little bit, what am I supposed to do with all of this? So the discernment through feeling, like in the tissues, I think, of the good feeling of falling into alignment, whether through an aha moment or whether through following the best guess intuition. And what is the pleasant when it's more happening through our conditioning? I like when someone smiled at me, I'm happy. So it's not that it's a bad thing when someone smiles at us, and even through the conditioned pleasure, we can access some opening. If we can have some basic trust, which is not an easy call. So where there's our openings towards what we like, what we find pleasant, through association, through past experience, through what we've been told, there can be excitement, and at the same time there is something is relaxed, something is for a moment reassured that maybe I'm okay after all. And in that semi-rest, sometimes we can, even if the person doesn't like me, there's still okayness, there's still preciousness. And we could think of what I used the word inspiration the other day. We could think of inspiration and intuition as partly overlapping. And maybe leaving room for intuition could be something like the daily bread. Going through our day. And inspiration could be something that's a little bit wider perspective, farther reach. The intuition may be a little more in touch with our mammal body. And that not in any way like a negative. And the inspiration also not a negative, that it might be like have kind of wider wings or something.
Decision making when there's two options.
Yeah. And that's, I think, I'm sure you have. And that's a good way, that's a good experiential sense of like, have I? Have I ever had a sense of that bigger wind moving me? Yes, but it is exactly like a bit farther from my personal memory. Less likely to be recorded as something I thought of or knew about, even, and yet somehow were carried by. So, kind of two kinds of guidance, leadership. One a little more warm, one a little more cool, one a little more close to the little more micro cosmos, and the other one a little more macro cosmos. Or it could be interesting to think about it in terms of an ecosystem where there's the really what's really near here, this particular way that the earth goes a little bit down here, and how that slightly affects the sound of the wind, and then the mountain or the mountain range or the tectonic plates even. And so I mentioned inspiration. We would usually think of passion as a positive thing in the that dominant sort of Americanized mainstream culture, like the bucket list sort of thing. So it's like, I'm thinking about my whole lifetime. I'm not thinking about today. I've got to climb Mount Everest and go on a safari and go deep sea diving. And it's like in my lifetime. So inspiration is also, we can think, kind of get a, not to make too much of a thing out of it, but just to get a sense of the reach of guidance that we're in need of, involved in, receptive to potentially with practice, and also the like care in the moment to moment, and those can be fully overlapping. It's not important to think of them as two separate things, really, but except in terms of opening ourselves to every help we can get, every innate capacity that we have for listening. And words can be so confusing because when there is an aha shift, often a lot of energy is released or available, and that can be scary. So there can be different ways that that does feel like excitement. There's feel suddenly too much energy for my system. So it's again the we fail to learn, like we fail as part of learning. And so is that really failure, or is failure the worst thing? But let me just go back. Sorry. If,
That's fine.
can you keep your
Yeah,
yeah.
totally.
Because this is also one of those things that's so much daily with us in the way we live, that it's just so much an ordinary occurrence that we will take pleasant means good, unpleasant means bad. And to disengage that alarm system from there. So, in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about the eight worldly conditions, which just means there are things that are going to happen to everybody regularly. And it's not an indication of your value as a spiritual practitioner, pilgrim, wanderer. And so it's pain and pleasure, it's loss and gain. And when in our current like individualistic culture, we so easily even more personalize everything, my success, my failure, my loss, my gain, my pain, my pleasure, my praise, my blame. The eight. That if someone is blaming me, I'll feel so ashamed that it's so my fault, so like something wrong with me, rather than something that triggers my conditioning in a way that feels pretty uncomfortable because it's wrongly interpreted as meaning something about me. And so just the possibility of living as a simple human being, that there can be praise and blame and there's something unshaken. It doesn't mean unresponsive. Like, there could be a need to respond in different ways. Like, no. I don't, you know, you're giving me praise for something that's absolutely not about me. Or similarly with blame. Or, yep, you're right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for that. So I guess this is kind of what I'm taking part of my question and asking about in a practical meditation.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Train that is attached to that and follows with like trying to refine that inspiration, and then I'm so it's like how much energy do I give that, because then usually what happens in the meditation is the maybe inspiration idea comes up that's different than the big wide inspiration. It's like little like seemingly good ideas. It's like that comes and then like something else comes and then I come back and I guess ask for clarity on that, like what should I do with that? Because some of it is like maybe I do want to do it, but it's also not here and it's not in my body. I'm gonna just check two things. Can you hear? Are you sure? Okay. Just feel free to move forward if would you be willing to give the more specific example?
Yes. So, okay, one example is I'm laying here and I get an idea like, oh, you know, if and when I go home, I could start like a gift circle or I could start a morning gathering to share with the community. Wow, that would feel great. Like, I really want to do that. And then I'm like, okay, great idea, Ashley. And then I, you know, not Ashley, it's not my idea. I'm like, great idea, thanks. Like, to me, universe, like, you know, I appreciate that because, you know, where did that come from? And then it's like, then I come back, and then, but then the thoughts start of like, okay, what's the gift circle gonna be like? What are you gonna include in the morning gathering? Who's gonna be, how are you gonna invite people? Are you gonna do an email circle and like all these things?
Yeah.
You know?
There's this great metaphor that Gautam gave in a kind of, I think it's a similar situation. So he was just giving a list of things that can take us from going in. And one of them is excitement. And the metaphor is, if someone were seeking treasure in a cave inside a mountain, and all of a sudden came upon, I don't remember how many he says, like 7 different entrances or 5 different entrances or whatever, to this, all to the same treasure, and kind of being blocked by the excitement of so many possibilities to get what I always wanted. And that as an impediment, as a stopping of the just kind of being carried or whatever. So it can be that thing of, it's not my fault, something's out of alignment sort of thing. And maybe to go, we can go both into what might be out of alignment a little more specifically, and also what might be like really wholesome ways of, that are so intuitive and so natural that we don't even realize we have them at hand. So the story that I told at the end yesterday, where the mother the acknowledgement that that might be in there somewhere, even in someone who might be like, oh no, I'm the best or whatever, but somewhere it might be living in there, lurking, or loud, or by turns, lurking and loud. And finding out where that is and what it's like for each of us is so important. So sometimes I talk about the sense of lack as one way, one phrase, or the sense that something's wrong, that there is a problem. Sometimes there's the sense that the world is the problem, or that person is the problem. Danger, me, my mind, my whatever. My disease, my... And so if I can just call it the sense of lack for now, getting to know the sense of lack, how it operates, what it feels like, what it says, and through friendliness, inner and outer, gradually the atmosphere of friendliness allows us to start to really be in touch with that pain. Which, what I find is that the sense of lack, the sense that something's wrong with me, or something's wrong, is a misunderstanding of our situation, but an understandable misunderstanding. I think that it's about our vulnerability. Going to die and be hurt, you know. How could it be that there would be war? I mean, just to name a few. And so it's almost like a very childlike, when we're really young and something terrible happens, we assume, we take it as my fault. I'm bad because this feels so bad. It's kind of like that. There's something not quite right here. And instead of it being like, oh, it's an antelope, we're like, something's wrong. And I just, the phrase in the poem, there's something wrong about the grass. That wrongness, we take it as something's wrong instead of our mind is about to open. If we can bear that uncomfortable shift from how I thought it would be and was to how it is and our clear perception of it, of what is. And so, but it's so understandable that we would experience our vulnerability or the way that our experience is so here and also not here, ungraspable and yet vivid. The uncertainty and yes, the closeness. Doesn't make sense. And we want it to make sense. We think it should make sense without changing the mind completely. We think it should make sense without an earthquake. Not to invoke any other natural disasters. So with as much friendliness as possible within ourselves and around us, I think gradually we can land, we can come to land in the actual vulnerability with less alarm. And instead of being in touch with my fear of what it means or what it is going to be or what it is, we're in it. And it's just like, yeah, relatively, there's so much vulnerability, relatively speaking. But I feel like in it, it's vulnerability, but it doesn't really feel vulnerable. Because we don't care in the same way. Things don't matter in that life-threatening way, funny enough. Like when we kind of come to terms with, yes, we're in a life-threatening situation all the time. So, that's the, like, where safety is not freedom comes alive. Enough safety that we can be in touch with what is. Safety in the sense of friendliness, really. Friendliness in the sense of togetherness with respect, like with an appropriate, like leaving room for everyone, including myself. And also leaving room for where we're all, like somehow all in that big wind together. And it's not even together because it's just not separate. So everything can bring us down to that vulnerability, which with friendliness we fall in touch, connection, not freaking out. And we can fall through, we can fall inside. And I think tenderness is the better word then. It's so tender, sometimes so raw. But there's also a sweetness. And there's also a wholeness that for me, tenderness speaks of a wholeness, even if it can feel sore. And I think that in the tenderness, we're protected from the way the mind will take a good idea and run with it when it's not time to run. Mm-hmm. And so maybe more often accepting silence as our instruction, or quiet, or stillness. We're looking to be told what to do.
Yeah, because it definitely, some of it definitely feels like if I were to do that, then my life would be okay.
Exactly. Trying to buy okayness. Exactly. Yeah. So that's when something matters in a way that is unhelpful and untrue. And it's not to say there's not a calling that's so fulfilling. But part of the art of feeling our calling is knowing when it's enough. Like now, enjoying the feeling of that idea and the feeling of already listening. Already feeling the yes. Already feeling there was leaving space and the wind blew through and the cell said yes. So there's the non-postponement is another way to think about what's not happening when it's like I'm already saying yes. And again, as you said, it's not really Ashley, but it is also Ashley. And that's part of the alignment of the yes. Ashley is saying yes to the movement of the wind that just came out of nowhere, seemingly. I've noticed that the time before, during, and after meditation, and also before, during, and after sleep, is a really good time that I'll receive my instructions of the day. And they might be instructions that are about more than today, or they might be about just now, today. And it's interesting to kind of reconstruct our thinking about awareness and awakeness and how hard it can be, especially for someone who loves meditating in the sense of the concentration. To play with a more restful approach, whether lying down or not, but a more restful approach, less of a tight leash, like on a dog. And so I wanted to tell a story about Thomas Edison. I've just realized I'm used to teaching in so many different places, but I guess you probably have all heard of Thomas Edison. Have you? Person, not to make him into much of a, you know, total hero, but he did have his ideas coming in. And he had a technique for getting his ideas that he called the genius gap. And it's so funny. And just goes to show, like, how eccentric one might end up finding oneself being. So he had his big desk, and he had his notepad and whatever pencil or something with the notepad on the desk. Next to the desk, a chair with armrests. In his right hand, ball bearings, so just metal balls, right? And under the right armrest was a cooking pot turned upside down, directly under his hand. And then he would get himself for his nap. And as soon as he would go into REM sleep, one of the characteristics of REM sleep, which is there's dreaming throughout, but when we really think of the dreaming, that's in REM, the rapid eye movement sleep. Because we could be so active if we were really that REM sleep, the body, the muscle tone is completely gone, except the eyes and the breathing and all that, but like the limbs and so on are completely without any tone. And so he's holding his ball bearings over the upside down cooking pot. I don't know why upside down. I thought that's like every day you've got to go like under the desk and get them off. But as soon as he goes into REM sleep, the hand releases the ball bearings onto the cooking pot, wakes him up, and he writes down his ideas. That was his way. Which does also seem rather alarming. Which is maybe why he didn't sleep enough at night. But anyway, I think with meditation through deep rest, we have the chance to have soft edges within the meditation and also post-meditation, also when there's been any sleep. And sometimes scientists have been using that. There's a half an hour period when you wake up from your nighttime sleep where you might have noticed you're still a little bit clumsy and a little bit dreamy. And they've used that to try to do some studies about REM sleep and why it's so healing and creative. But so just to kind of harvest some of our innate creativity that's happening, when we think about dreams, one of the main characteristics is that the mind is not following the rules. The horse is suddenly green and then it's in the air, but it doesn't have wings, you know, or whatever. And maybe also the location of the me is very fluid, or like even more than fluid. It can be simultaneously here and there. It can be so many things. And so when we're in a soft state, that whether it's a micro judgment or a huge judgment that my mind is so dreamy, and the assumption that that's a wrong thing, the possibility of feeling for the quality of stillness while letting the mind be that fluid or in that mood, maybe not quite as fluid as dreaming, but in that mood where we're not following the rules and me is a movable thing. Sometimes it may be worth writing something down. And sometimes there starts to be that feeling of refreshment that comes with even a big task that is on our list of instructions for the day, a feeling of refreshment. And a kind of commitment or discipline, but it's more in the way of, that's so juicy, and I'm so thirsty, and this world is so dry, that we start to know we're going to keep visiting that more restful state and continue the conversation more consciously. But it's not to exclude sometimes writing something down or making a little image if you're more image-oriented or whatever. And then again, noticing when the mind is like busy. Do you want to say something? Okay.
Questions I have around that, and then also people that I encounter confused about it, like,
we're going with the flow of life, and then there's so much messaging around, like, you have to know what you want for it to ever come near you.
Yeah.
Which I don't believe, but somewhere between those two is, mm-hmm. seems true.
Yeah. So. Cool. But the poem I wanted to read is really also that, but if we would think of, could you hear? Not quite. Maybe one or two line summary.
What is it like when the idea's been there or the inspiration's been there and then something is starting to form around you? And then also, do you have to know what you want so clearly for it to be coming towards you?
Mm-hmm. So the phrase, to know what you want, we can play with that. So thinking about the thing about point and pointless, in this context, like, if I know what I want, and what I want is a green water bottle that's like 10 years old or whatever, maybe that is what I'm gonna get. Is that what I wanted? Why did I want that? Knowing what you want, and what you want is not necessarily a thing, or a person, or a place, but what do you want in that person, place, thing, mind state, idea of liberation, whatever. And so then what kind of knowing? If it's a conceptual knowing, then you might harvest conceptual harvest. And if it's a more inner knowing that may be more wordless and it's less it's really less of what I want. Or it's, yeah, I want what that movement wants. I don't know why. And I don't care what it looks like. The alignment is what I want. So, what I have found important with the organization Open Dharma, since you mentioned that specifically, has been a real commitment not to let the structure be more important than what the structure serves. So sometimes we're in the mood and we go with the flow and without thinking about it, and there's trust, and that's the key ingredient. And that's also where it can be confusing, because it feels so good and we are following our intuition. And then what about when it doesn't feel so good? Does that mean my intuition is lost, my flow is lost? And so there's the gradual training and refinement of our knowing, if we want to call it that, or our sensitivity, responsiveness, kind of connection. Mostly we're so sensitive and we didn't know we were allowed to be responsive, and so we're kind of stuck. There's an overload of how much we've perceived, received, experienced. And so gradually starting to connect receptivity, sensitivity, and responsiveness. And we're taught that it's two opposites, like you're active or you're passive. You're a go-getter or you're letting it come to you or whatever. And it certainly is both. Samadhi, which is a word for deep meditation, includes ksham, which is the not freaking out, the steadiness, which means there's not the activation or deactivation shutdown from it's not, we're afraid that when we're just quiet, then what? And what happens when that's, when there's, I'm less active and passive through my conditioning, and I'm, there's, it's more fluid and flexible and responsive. There's also more, we're more easily guided. It doesn't come to a standstill. We're afraid it will, and we're so activated that a little bit quiet feels like a standstill. And so one of the parts of the path is like what feels like a standstill, and we're like, this is death, this is the end of the world, this is like when I feel traumatized and frozen, those kind of reactions to what feels like a standstill. And then we get accustomed to, oh, not burning up so much of our energy unnecessarily, a wider field, more resources, more like maybe life is beautiful even though there are so many terrible things, including my own. And just that non-reactivity, like the not active or passive unnecessarily based on the past, leaves room for a chemistry and a flow that moves us in a way that's better than like being passionate about something. It doesn't, it's not burning us. It's a fluid, precise direction. And so some, they're just training in listening and responding. And sometimes it's easy, and sometimes we have to really be very basic. And so I came across this Rumi poem today. It's just a part from a long poem called The Granary Floor. A granary is where we'd store grains. A Sufi, and Sufi means like wool, so like warmth of connection, warmth of the yes. A Sufi book is not composed with ink and alphabet. A scholar loves and lives on the marks of a pen. Sufi loves footprints. She sees those and stalks her game. At first, she sees the clues. After a time, she can follow the scent. To go guided by fragrance is 100 times better than following tracks. So it's sort of spending time with less verbal, less words, less concept, less me setting my intention on, which is so much this, the individualized worldview that I have an inspiration that shapes reality. And how do we know what came first? Something coming toward me and me receiving a sense of that, or me having a sense of that and something coming toward me? I think it's hubris to decide and to be certain that I come up with the intention from where, and that I have any clue about how to weave together anything, a flower, a group of people, a word. Oh yeah.
Opposite of humble.
It's a human something. It's something that happens to all of us, probably every day, where we think that, or it's really I think I, could be we, my group, and I think that we believe that we can, through our muscle, or through our greatness, or through our whatever, maybe just pure bravado, or maybe through how humble we are, even. We're so humble. The typical story is of Icarus and Daedalus. So the father was this, I think he was actually an architect, but anyway, he was asked to make wings, and he used wax and feathers, I think, and made these wings, and then it was possible for a human being to fly in this sort of limited way. And Icarus, the son, who had a karmic debt, by the way, it wasn't just out of the blue, but anyway, he had really broken from a sense of reciprocity in life, and sort of taken as if this is it's up to me. So if I want to, I will, and if I will, then I can. And the more someone tries to stop me, the more, you know. So a little bit like teenager, where when we're 16. We don't know that our brain hasn't fully formed yet, and especially the prefrontal cortex hasn't come all the way in. So we don't have good judgment. So Icarus took the wings without permission and was having so much fun flying that he, of course, went too close to the sun. And the wax melted and he plummeted to the earth. That's the typical story of hubris. Where we might find hubris on a daily basis, and especially up close with our mind states, is where we think that it's my fault. Or we have a good session and we're like, say no to what?
Like my job, or
okay.
Even like a person. Mm-hmm. You know?
Definitely good to say no to people sometimes. So okay, one thing that might be going on is that sort of where we when something matters to us, then it gets really either or. And it's just so much more of an art and a craft. So we wouldn't say, like, if we wanted to paint, we wouldn't say, like, well, just use black, and no matter what you do with the black, you know, you're good. You might use black sometimes. It might be mixed with a little red, or it might be, like, just a very fine, or, a bit, you know, there's just so many ways to use black. And certainly remember that you have black in your palette. So there's no in refinement. But refining no sometimes means that there's permission when it's a really loud no. It's not refinement like getting really quiet onto, you know, ballet shoes or something. So there's so much in there. Let's see how we can go. So one thing is where why does it matter? But not assuming that we already know the answer before we even ask the question. So part of it is getting to know the structures of the very good idea of living a fulfilling life, living wholeheartedly, living to the best of my capacity, living, unfolding my gifts, living at the service of the best of humanity or life or nature or whatever, the divine or whatever. And then that's that good idea that can be used as a weapon. When there's an underlying sense of something wrong with me, or a wound that's unattended, and is looking for the reassurance through, when I believe that I am fulfilling my purpose in life, then I have permission to be here and to feel okay. And when I believe that I'm not fulfilling my mission in life, then I don't have permission to feel okay and even to be here. So that's conditioning. That's interference. And so that's what we're quieting down so that we can hear better. And in that, sometimes disappointment is a really true phenomenon. Like the other day, was it the word despair or something like that? Like disappointment that by doing this work that I'm really good at and that helps people, I'm not satisfied, for example. The disappointment could be helping us start to feel that putting off into the future, like, and making it conditional, like, if I feel this way, or if I do that, then I'm okay. Then I'm a child of God. So rather than calling into question your possibilities, your gifts, your capacity, your competence, it's calling into question the system, the approach, the whole approach of postponement. There's a horrible and accurate metaphor from one of my favorite Sanskrit books about this, and it's where there's a dog with a dry bone. The bone has nothing left of nourishment, and that means it's like this brittle, sharp object. The dog sees bone, grabs the bone, and is chewing the bone, which is so sharp that it's cutting the dog's mouth, so there's a taste of blood. It's a horrible image. So that tiny little taste of blood, our own blood, we think it's food from somewhere. We think it's an interaction with something other than ourselves. And it's the jail that we're trying to keep ourselves chained into. And so if the approach could include like meeting the wound with soothing, with contact, connection, that is at the right distance with the right quality, I don't mean only only physical contact at all. Sometimes no physical contact is important. And then if 10% of our emphasis is on dealing with, working with, getting to know, and translating the difficult, the sense of lack, the wound, the sense of not enough, something's wrong with me, the sense of displacement, misalignment, and also including things like disappointment, that actually there's some truth in it, but not maybe the way you think at first. But 10%. 90%. The practice of feeling fulfillment already now. And if not fulfillment already now, if that doesn't feel even a whiff true, then is it or isn't it true that we would love to feel fulfilled now? Or whatever word, loved, love, home, upliftment, finished. Seemingly nothing there, and possibly nowhere to go. And it's like entering a dark room that really looks dark until we've stayed a while, and then we can see a little bit. We expect to be able to see first, and then we're going to go in, because we trust that more cerebral. I'm gonna plan out my life first, and then I'm going to live it. And even the best ideas, there's, you know, living is most important. So at first, we're in the poem, at first we see the clues. We see the clues. So we could even start from the poem yesterday, where even to see the clues is a whole thing. That's partly luck and partly just some sort of instinct that turned back, and then something came across that we were open to somehow. And then, oh, right, okay. And then after a time, we can follow the scent. So after a time, the trust grows just through our experiencing, through failure, through success, through boredom, through nothing at all seems to be happening, nothing seems to be there. Then I noticed, I think there's something wrong with nothing being there, and then I realize something is there, etc. It's all different from the map. I think that we slowly start to really enjoy following the scent. We really enjoy being, you know, okay, we're blind. It takes a long time because we expect to see. To see it in advance from a distance. And to get up close where we can feel our way is a process. Just briefly, in further response to what Jessica was saying earlier, is there a way of planning or helping things organize in a wholesome way, in a good way, in a fun way? In a way that's not just exciting now, but may last somehow. The way that that can last. just as a background. Just for today, I was looking up a couple of things about exactly Jesse's question, and one of them is another Rumi line, which is actually how I came across this poem, that I haven't found, so I'm not sure if it's a correct quotation, but of the thousands of times I've lost the connection, your fragrance draws me back. Of the thousands of times I've lost the connection, your fragrance draws me back. So rather than me telling me to pay attention to me, me is just really busy losing the connection, and yet some fragrance draws me back. So that's our practice. And then it was pretty funny, another good example of like how we might get more clear. We might have the mind be more supple and open and responsive. Because I was like, what was that thing that my friend who's really good in craniosacral therapy, what did he say about, what was it? The emergent best treatment? Was it the implicit best treatment? And so I actually Googled inherent emergent best treatment. And you can imagine what kinds of things came up. It was really funny. But then I thought, oh, right, craniosacral would be a good phrase to add to the search phrase. And craniosacral is just a way that someone can help another person come into harmony by tuning in. And so the phrase is also not a great phrase, I find, but anyway, inherent treatment plan. So inherent means it's already in. Treatment plan. So I think it's kind of a hilarious name, actually. Especially then the description of, the very, very holy description of, and also technical description of how they practice allowing the inherent treatment plan to arise, to emerge. Which of course is what we do in meditation. And so it starts by some quieting. What a surprise. And in the quiet, once we're a little bit quiet, and we might not even think I'm quiet, we might think, oh my God, my mind is going even more crazy today. I thought by day three I would be. But we are more quiet now. It's easier for us to tell from outside of the silence. Your lovely fragrance. And so it just so happens that when there's some quieting, then there's some alignment that starts to happen with something bigger than me. And again, me might be busy complaining, but some bit of alignment. Which might feel like a softening, dropping, sinking, spreading kind of thing. And might also feel like I don't need to have a bubble, that it's just me. But there's a sense of life flowing through me, or I'm in nature and I am nature. So a sense of what they call a field. And in the field, there is something about what we talked of yesterday, of safety. So respect and giving space enough, like how close, how far is appropriate, not as a strict rule, but as a feeling. So that word reciprocity and reverence again. And then there's a settling of the field. Like it starts to feel maybe a little more normal that I feel so heavy and maybe sometimes a little bit also light or open or wide. Or, and meanwhile, the mind is still eating me up, maybe even. But somewhere I'm like, maybe that's really not a problem. And then there's that trust thing. So enough of a position towards feeling comfortable and the quality of stillness. I think yesterday I wasn't quite clear when the way I translated the Yoga Sutra line about posture. So when I said there is a way that your body can be happily still, I think that we could say there is a positioning of the body where we can enjoy the quality of stillness. It would be more encompassing, so that when we're in movement also, we can feel that this movement is helpful for feeling a quality of stillness. So basically the feeling of quieting enough, that there's a little bit of a shift, that there might still be definitely a very heavy-duty small me, but there might also be possibly, I'm open to maybe there's also big mind. Maybe there's also something big that's not separate from me and not against me. And when that's there, I start to open a little bit or a lot to what I thought wasn't me. And that can allow some kind of resonance. And they call it the holistic shift. It seems to be that basically when there's enough safety, enough care about the practical things that we can fiddle with, like the position, like more friendliness in our lives, good rhythm in the day, and permission to be childlike. What I would describe as a shift from safety to trust. A shift from safety seeking to safety receiving to recovering trust. I sometimes talk about it, and we can go into this more another day, maybe if we want to, need to, of kind of passing through a membrane. So sometimes we know, like, just nearby, just there, is it's okay, but I'm not don't feel okay, and the membrane shift, like, enough good conditions, patient enough with that to kind of build a momentum or gather the energy, and then the passing through it. Yeah, and maybe the other ways that I sometimes speak about it we'll say for another day. But the way they talked about it on this one person of craniosacral said, after the holistic shift, then healing processes naturally begin to emerge. So in a way, it's like, duh. Quieting, some kind of alignment and opening to something, a bigger presence and field. That might be sometimes joyful, that might be sometimes a sense of lightness, or just maybe really quiet, might be less sense of location or limits of the body. With listening can allow resonance. And then it's by just staying tuned to out of nowhere something moves, healing happens. And then there's just one quotation that I really did like that I think is a good description. So he said, once conditional forces have been resolved, so meaning once our conditioning is dissolved, then a process of reorganization and realignment to natural processes and midlines also occurs. So I would put it a little bit differently, like when we've let some of the smoke, you know, come out. We've healed some of the patterns of interference that have been in the way of our listening. Enough. Then we'll start to feel a process of reorganization and realignment happening that we gladly join. And he says a realignment to natural processes and midline. So we could think of that as a kind of what's deeply within in potential, like those seeds of enlightenment or those seeds of liberation, of kindness, of unconditional being and love, here-ness, a realignment to loving what we love, which is a natural process and a kind of center or centeredness. But what I'm adding in there is like good enough, a good enough position, enough stillness and settling, enough sense of welcome, just enough that you feel a little bit of resonance. Maybe you're not completely alone, even when you feel like so lonely or so isolated. But then it's like, oh yeah, so is everybody. And also we're not, you know, the ground and life is here. And just good enough allows this huge process and coming home. Just a little bit is enough. So thank you for your patience.